don't know if you know, but there are a lot of studies done because they said the people that were working on printed circuits and things like that would have to work in an atmosphere of high lighting intensity, which meant a lot of stealing fluorescent lights over the work areas. And they found when they used low lighting intensities, people tended to relax and not work hard. So these gurus that do human evaluation, so to speak, of work areas, they were into high intensity lighting. And it turns out that the iris of the eye, which is like the device that makes the lens opening on a camera, the iris of the eye closes down to make the pupil a pinpoint when you have a very bright light. And it's great because it makes your eye focus better. But it's also, if you do it long enough, you got to realize that that iris is a muscle. And it gets muscle strained in long periods of time. And so you have to have work breaks if you're going to work in high-intensity lighting. And a lot of these experiments where they worry about the flickering of the lighting are not as important as the intensity of the lighting. So there's another thing for industrial engineering. But we're off the subject. So I'll let it drop again because I have more to say on some things you said. Go on the Grumman website, you see that I've started a communication theory course, minus the high-level mathematics, and I'm going to try to write a series of articles about that. Getting the signal above the noise, and seeing the signal even when it's below the noise. And that's all part of communication theory that the public is shielded from, but us hams, we like to hear the little weak DX signals in the noise, so we still work with the noise. The general public that gets their television from a cable and their radio from cables and their computer from cables or fibers, they don't deal with the noise, but the hams still do. So we're the ones who should really worry about it. But getting back to antennas again, and I'll let it drop. Getting back to antennas again, and I have my my Heathkit dummy load in front of me. And I was looking at it. The Heathkit dummy load has a non-inductive resistor in it, and it's, in my particular case, submerged in transformer oil. And if you measure the resistor with an ohmmeter, it is 50 ohms. And this particular one works pretty good. They promise only 1.5 maximum VSWR up to 300 megahertz. And less than 2 up to 400 megahertz. And why do they deteriorate the rating? They deteriorate it because there is some things there due to the connections to the ohm resistor. So it isn't perfectly 50 ohms. It's got a slight complex impedance involved with it. And you were talking about putting a coil in parallel with a 50 ohm load, so that would that would work the same way. It would be cause a crazy impedance. And I was talking about antenna couplers or tuners between the HF transceivers on aircrafts and the antennas on aircrafts that are intended to work from 2 to 30 megahertz. HF is 3 to 30, but they work from 2 to 30. I'll let it drop again. Well, the antennas on aircraft, in the old days of propeller aircrafts, you actually used long wire antennas. For instance, I was working for TWA in 1956, but I still flew prop-driven Lockheed Constellations across the Atlantic, and they had a mast above where the pilot's cockpit was, and two long wire antennas going back to the tail fins. If you know how the Lockheed Conny is, it has two vertical tail fins. So the two HF antennas would go back there. And on early versions of the plane, they actually had a radio operator who could send Morse. And he had an R-13 transmitter that he tuned up manually. But lo and behold, they got the Boeing jets, and they did away with the radio operators and the navigators in about 1955-56. Oh, it dropped again. And the reason they did away with them is they saved money by not having such a large crew. And also the flights took a lot less time with the jets, and there wasn't even time for a radio operator operating normal Morse to get much of a message across. The HF aeronautical bands were used mainly to communicate with the company. They were not used so much for navigation. You have navigators for that, but they were used for guys asking when they would be able to pick up their paycheck from the company. For instance, TWA had a center in Kansas City. So they tried to work Kansas City, and they were at pretty high altitude. But when you think about the antennas on the 707 were probe antennas that were out in the wings. They stuck out in front of the tubes. And the actual antenna coupler was out there in the wings also. Now, there's all kinds of configurations with aircrafts where they tried to use an all-band HF transceiver. For instance, on the corporate aircraft like the Grumman Gulfstream, it was originally a Grumman Gulfstream, but of course they sold the rights to other companies, and they no longer make it, but the vertical tail structure, the vertical tail fin, has its leading edge insulated by some sort of a compound configuration that can withstand better than 3,000 volts. And that vertical on the tail fin is all there is to the HF antenna. So naturally, if you turn up something like that, you're not dealing with a resonant antenna for the most part. And you're dealing with an antenna that has a great deal of limitation. It has a certain capacity to the aircraft structure, which is basically ground and so forth. So what they do when they test up this system that drives that, which is a 718 U4, the system consists of two boxes. One is an exciter receiver, and the other box is a power amplifier antenna coupler. That thing has to see a complex impedance that no ham in his right mind would ever deal with. And so to test it, we have a box that we could call a dummy load for it, but it contains capacitance reactors, it contains inductance, and it contains resistance that models what that fin looks like. And the amount of power that's actually radiated by the fin varies greatly over the tuning range that this thing has. Of course, for the most part, it can only be used on aeronautical frequencies, but in emergency see it could even be used on the handbands. And what would sell such a creature, I don't know, because the thing tunes in increments of 10 kilohertz. Doesn't tune smoothly like a hand transceiver. The original models of the 618 tuned in 100 kilohertz steps.
9, 1, 2, 6.
And like I said, what we have really shattered.
Repeater, timeout.
Good timing. You just dropped it out 10 seconds ago.
Okay, Dick, and there was one other subject I want to get to. If you get back, I'll let you make whatever comments you want because I've been holding it pretty long. So back to you, Dick, from W2ILT.
It sounds, Bob, like you have lived two or three consecutive lives with your experience with the airliners and other experiences. When it comes to which portion of the frequency spectrum represents the greatest danger to human beings, the ANSI report has a set of graphs that over the years have gotten more and more complicated, but the gist of those graphs are that the most dangerous region is believed to be the VHF region between 30 and 300 megacycles. That of all the RF energy that hits your body at that frequency region, the vast majority of it is absorbed and turned into heat. And whether or not that heat is excessive or not excessive for that particular portion of your body determines whether or not it's going to give you any biological grief, upset of the operation of those organs, damage, whatever. The so-called microwave region, according to the graph, starting at around 1,500 megahertz and above, is pound for pound 5-to-1 safer. In other words, the maximum permitted
Welcome
exposure.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
The maximum permitted exposure above 1,500 megahertz is 5 times greater than the maximum permitted exposure between 30 to 300, because in that so-called microwave region, 1,500 megs and above, megahertz and above, 20% of the energy penetrates your body and is absorbed and turned into heat. 80% of it reflects off your skin. Rough rule of thumb. Everyone believes the microwave region is the most dangerous. If you did a test pound for pound, the same number of milliwatts per square centimeter, the microwave region is 5-to-1 safer. There is a catch to this. The microwave equipment has the ability to do more concentrating. You open up a piece of waveguide and you look down it. It's a little bit equivalent to looking down the rifle of a gun. You're getting a very concentrated amount of energy aimed at that portion of your body, and you're pushing your luck. But except for those kinds of differences, the microwave region is actually safer. Opposite of common sense. Let me drop. And you were feeling, Bob, that the holes in your head were allowing lots of RF energy to get into your cranium. And you're probably speaking of the eye sockets and the mouth and the nose and the ears. And you're talking about the holes in the bones. At VHF and UHF frequencies, the bones are actually more transparent than the rest of your body. You may think the eye sockets are allowing more energy in. The eye sockets have more fluid-containing substances, and water is an extremely good dummy load at VHF and UHF frequencies. The way the water molecule works is very similar to what happens inside of your microwave oven. When you cook your food in the microwave oven, you think you're cooking a hamburger, and you think you're cooking an egg, for instance. You think you're cooking your bowl of cereal that you want to be warm. For the most part, you are cooking the water that's in the hamburger, the water that's in the egg, and the water that's in that bowl of cereal is where a high percentage of the RF energy is being absorbed and turned into heat. If you put a thoroughly dried out piece of bread in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water, and you cook the microwave oven for 30 seconds, the glass of water will get hot, the very dried out piece of bread will stay ice cold. Sprinkle some water on the bread and do it again, and it will get hot. Put a snowball in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water. The glass of water will start boiling. Nothing will happen to the snowball. The snowball is made out of frozen water. When water freezes, it chemically, as far as the microwave oven is concerned, turns into an extremely different substance. Let me drop. That's the main reason why your microwave oven has a so-called defrost cycle. On that defrost cycle, it turns on the power for a while, turns it off for a while, turns it on for a while. If you put thoroughly frozen meat in a microwave oven, the ice does not absorb RF energy. The little portion of the hamburger, so to speak, that will melt first will suck up all of the RF energy. That portion will become overcooked, and the frozen portion alongside of it will stay ice cold. And you'll have a really weird mixture that's not fun to eat. By way of the so-called defrost cycle, you know you're going to heat some portion of it. By going into a delay, you hope that the hot portion slowly, thermally, by conduction, spreads its heat to the frozen portion. Then the microwave oven turns on again, and eventually you get more even heating. You cannot defrost frozen food rapidly in a microwave oven. Opposite of common sense. Now, when it comes to the last, one of the last subjects you discussed, let me drop. The leading edge of the vertical stabilizer on some of those aircraft, where the antenna was very far from resonance, and you would think it's an extremely inefficient structure. As long as you're using low-loss materials, everything you call antenna is really a radiating system. The radiating system consists of the thing you call antenna, the thing you call an impedance matching device, might be an antenna tuner right at the antenna, it might be a passive set of inductors and capacitors, but the antenna tuner, plus the feed line, if it's low enough in loss, plus the final stage of the transmitter. All of those components I just mentioned are the radiating system. If you want to really radiate signal relatively efficiently, you will resonate not just the antenna. You will resonate that radiating system. The antenna itself could be tuned to 37 megacycles, and by way of the action of all of those other components, the total system, including that 37 meg antenna, is now resonating at 50 megacycles, and as long as you've used low-loss components, you will radiate the majority of your 50 megacycle signal you apply to that system. You don't have to resonate the antenna. Obvious by what happens when you put a loading coil on the antenna or a top hat capacitor. That's if you're doing it right at the antenna itself. Well, if you did it 2 inches away down the feed line, would that stop it from operating? Of course not. And if your feed line is low enough in loss and you put that loading coil or that matching capacitor at the input end of a short feed line, you can do that too. Walt Maxwell, W2DU, who worked, let me drop, he worked for the space division, RCA Astro, on the Tyros satellites, the weather satellites, running at something like 136 megacycles. And he had some kind of a taped dipole-like antenna wrapped around the outside of the satellite, and when they cut the squib when it was deployed in space, the taped dipole would spring out, and the taped dipole was quite far away from resonance. And he wasn't able to make it the right size within the physical constraints for that spacecraft. Walt Maxwell did the impedance matching at the transmitter end of the feed line inside of that satellite. And the engineers he worked with at RCA Astro gave him a lot of flack. He described that incident to me on the TechNet, oh, about 20 or so years ago. And they said, it ain't going to work. They put it in the chamber, they tested it, and they said, holy cow, how the hell did you do that? And Walt's answer was, as long as the feed line is low enough in loss, I can do essentially all of the impedance matching and resonating at the transmitter end of the feed line. And the Tyro satellite did it. That was a rather successful project. And the conventional wisdom of the engineers coming out of the school told him he could not do that. He said, hey, I've been around for 30 years. I've done this before. Take my word for it. It's going to work. Now, if your feed line is high in loss, and if your antenna tuner it doesn't have quality components, yes, all of this goes down the tubes. I'll admit that. But as long as you resonate the radiating system with the right kind of components, as homely as that antenna may be, when you test the antenna electronically all by itself, I say you can make it fly. As an occupation, as a consultant for the last 10 years, I put antennas in very poor places where no one in his right mind would put an antenna. And I make it work. And they pay me to do that. And they keep paying me to do that because they think it keeps working. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say it's the best way to do it. But if your back's against the wall and you pull out all the stops that a good RF engineer has, you can make it work. That's a strongly felt opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. I accept that. W2ILP, go right ahead, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet. This is W2ILP. Well, the story is, say you have a vertical whip antenna, and you put a loading coil near the base of that, actually between the base and the shock mount or whatever. The antenna pattern is going to change, but all your expected power can be radiated. Now suppose you take that loading coil part and instead of putting it between the shock mount and the whip, you mount it in a box inside the trunk of the car. The antenna system is still resonant. But the part that the loading coil is not radiating. The radiation resistance is not all at the antenna. And this is what I'm trying to drive at. Nevertheless, I've seen a hand that is very experienced, high-speed CW operator, and he can load up the gutters on. He starts out with 100 watts, and he uses Morse code telegraphy, and he can work all continents. Why? Because if he gets 5 watts out, this guy will be able to work DX. He's a good operator. But his antenna system is not very efficient. It's very lossy. Plus, it's not resonant in any usual mode. And a lot of his energy is wasted in his antenna tuner. Now, if he's feeding anything near resonance, his antenna tuner could trim it up and match the impedance of it, and view up getting most of his power out. Now back to the microwave ovens. Yeah, I spent a lot of time discussing this with Hams, Ham groups, when we were really getting into RF safety. And as you say, the water content, or the oil content in food, presents itself as a lossy dielectric to a microwave cavity, because the volume inside the microwave is a cavity. It's a cavity resonator, and you can go into the TE modes that it supports. It's pretty easy to support the microwaves into molding within a cavity, because they're so short in length that you could picture them fitting in there as rectangles in there and filling up the whole space with energy. And it's electromagnetic energy, and the food you put in there is USC dielectric. Now, Ed Hare argued with me that the food gets heated from the surface inward, to which I could prove that it doesn't. One of the problems is if you put something like cocoa, or something that's highly pulverized, into the water,
link clear.
And when you put it in the microwave, the thing explodes and overruns. That's because each granule gets precise moments in the whole volume of the liquid. And if they were heated up slowly as they would over a stove by convection from the heat on the bottom, they would explode that violently. I'll drop. The big problem that's still going on, testing is still going on in Europe. The British are getting into it very strongly now, and the Scandinavians have been for some time. The Italians are very concerned because one of the first microlinks in the world was set up by Marconi. Yes, Marconi himself set up a microwave link between the Vatican and the Pope's summer home. And this was done a long time ago, prior to World War II. So, it's a microwave link that's been there a long time. And along the path of that microwave link, it may be just coincidence, but the Italians displaying is the more cases of cancer develop among the inhabitants of that particular area. And so the equivalent to our FCC has actually sued them. And a lot of these things don't get reported as much as they should. And of course a lot of people are paranoid about it, but I don't try to be paranoid about it. But I do believe that there are, other than the thermal immediate effects of RF, that can affect the human. To be done. And cell phones haven't been around that long. It might take 40 or 50 years for them to do their damage. And whether that's or not, as you say, the risks, because the benefits may not make it worth doing anything about, but it's still something to consider. I'll let it drop.
Alright, I'm going to stop this now because this is three times that we've timed out already, and this gentleman keeps talking way too long. Okay, through again. Hey, you ought to set your timer, Bob, and do an interruption roughly every minute and a quarter or so. Other than that, the link to the internet gets timed out, and the people listening out of the area get great big interruptions, and they get a little bit frustrated. Back to you, Bob.
Yeah, I got to really be cool, because I tend to be very long-winded. And it's getting late. I'm not going to carry on too much longer. I wanted to discuss VHF antennas, their impedances, and their evolution. Because as a youngster, I started out being interested in radio and, of course, television when I was only 8 years old. And on the roofs of the Bronx where I lived, and this was long before I was an engineer or a technician or anything of the sort, I watched the slow development of television antennas. And I have a whole talk I could give about that and why they developed the way they did from the first 300 ohm type antennas that were for the dipoles onto the straight dipoles, which were, as you know, could be fed with coax, and then to the conicals. And the conicals will match any impedance. And there's a complete explanation from that. But a straight dipole won't, even though I know you are advocate that a straight dipole will match any impedance. I beg to differ. And due to measurements that I've seen myself made. So I'm not going to hold it longer, Dick. And the only last thing that you said, I want to drop once. The only last thing that you said last week that really got me going, because it's in the area of metaphysics, is that you think we're in the center of the universe. I don't know how you could come to that conclusion, because for all we know, the universe is infinite in all directions and there is no center. But even if it was, we'd be pretty egocentric to believe that we're in the center of it. We're in the center of the known universe. But every time we get the range out of our instrumentation, we find there's more stars and galaxies out there. So back to you, Dick, and this will be my final. Go ahead.
KC2QIQ.
You want to make a comment, Glenn?
No, sorry, Dick. It wasn't a comment. Actually, I just wanted to ask you for a little bit of time afterwards just to talk about feed lines and some measurements that I made this week. But I wanted to wait till everybody was done with the other conversation first. KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'll put your name on the list. And near 11 o'clock, we do have to at least start going over to Mel's mailbag, because we've been delaying that over the last few weeks, and we've been getting some flack on that. When you spoke of moding of a microwave oven, what that really means is a kind of three-dimensional waveguide standing wave ratio. When you set up a coaxial cable, for instance, with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, if you had a very long slotted line piece of test equipment that you put in the middle of that coaxial cable with a 2-to-1 Viswar load on it, you would find that every half wave you go through a cycle of peaks and valleys of voltage or current. So the standing wave in a coax cable, you could say voltage-wise, has some hot spots every half wavelength. And in the case of a microwave oven, that hot spot is occurring approximately every half wavelength in the X dimension, the Y dimension, and the Z dimension. So in that microwave oven, which is usually multiple wavelengths in dimensions, let me drop, there are hot spots. And that's the reason why your microwave oven has a rotisserie, a turntable, that either moves the food, or above the transparent ceiling of the microwave oven, there's a blade that rotates that moves the microwaves around. If you didn't do that, the hot spots would burn your food in some places and not cook them in other. So that's what Bob was mentioning when he used the word moding within the microwave oven. When you switch over from coax cable, which is one-dimensional, to the cavity of a microwave oven, it really is a three-dimensional device, but you still have standing waves in those X, Y, and Z directions. So there are hot spots in three-dimensional space in the microwave oven, and by rotating your food, you're rotating those hot spots through your turkey or whatever you're cooking. When it comes to the coil, let me drop. When it comes to the coil at the bottom, the whip coil or the whip antenna, with the loading coil at the bottom as well as the spring, when you study the way the current flows through that loading coil is primarily a point source inductor. It is a solenoidal coil. And what magnetic field it makes is primarily parallel to the whip itself. So it's creating a magnetic field parallel to the whip, and the whip is trying to create an electrostatic field parallel to the whip. So I'm saying that most reasonable designs of a loading coil, the coil itself does very little radiation. It's too small in diameter in wavelengths. It's too small in length in wavelengths. And the layout of its wire is at right angles to the whip, so it does very little radiating. So if you've got an efficient coil right at the base where the spring is, or you put that coil some distance down the transmission line, but keep it efficient, I say there's very little difference in radiation pattern or radiation efficiency. I will admit that as you move that loading coil, let me drop it. As you move that loading coil up the whip in various locations, you're changing the distribution of current magnitude along the whip, and you will change the vertical elevation pattern out of that antenna. So the loading coil, as you move it along the whip, does change the pattern, and various people have opinions as to where's the best place to put the loading coil for various lengths of whip to get the most desirable elevation pattern. When it comes to a dipole impedance matching, one frequency at a time, I've written an article that you can read by going to amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can read my article on so-called getting a perfect impedance match to a dipole. One frequency at a time. I didn't say that the technique is broadband, but if you've got a favorite frequency, a sweet spot in the band that you care about, and you let me adjust the length of your antenna in feet, if it's a wire dipole, for instance, and you allow me to put a shunt capacitor across the center of the feeding point of that dipole, and you allow me to adjust those two things against each other, I can make your dipole a perfect impedance match no matter what your transmission line is. I don't care if your transmission line is 10 ohms, 50 ohms, 70 ohms, 100 ohms, 300 ohms, 600 ohms. I can give you a perfect impedance match at one frequency by making just those two adjustments. Of course that's radical. Of course that's opposite from everything you've read up till now. If you understand what the Brown and Woodward curves have been saying.
Repeater, timeout.
Yuck, now I did it. Oh well, sorry about that. If you understand what the Brown and Woodward curves have been saying, those Brown and Woodward curves are in Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook since the first edition. All five editions have it in Chapter 4, but in Chapter 3 of the first edition of Antenna Engineering Handbook, the so-called JASIC Handbook is what it was called in the beginning. If you understand what Brown and Woodward did in that man year of work, where they measured every possible antenna diameter and length that's reasonable, and swept it in frequency and told you exactly what the resistive component is and what the reactive component is. If you understand that set of curves, Brown and Woodward are telling you you can get a perfect impedance match, if you know what you're doing, by just adjusting length and reactance at the center with a center-fed half-wave-like dipole. You might make it quite a bit less or quite a bit longer than a half-wave, and there's nothing magic about using that particular impedance matching within the center of a Yagi antenna. I know there are people who disagree with me on this one. I've gotten lots of letters of people who said, it's about time somebody told me to do that. Let me drop. And it's about time somebody told me how to do that. I did it, and I love it. I've had essentially no flack on that one, Bob. That one has been extremely well accepted among the people who read the article. But the article itself sounded boring to the magazines I sent it to, and they refused to print it. Now, you could say that they refused to print it because they felt it was wrong. And maybe you're right. Maybe that's the reason they refused to print it. Maybe the jury is still out. We'll find out. Okay. Bob and I have gotten into some pretty heavy subjects, as you can tell. And let's see now. We do have at least one more person on the list before Glenn. And I guess we're not going to get too far into it tonight, Wesley, but as I told you, if you mail an email to Wesley, I'm going to make an offer here in Wesley's name, and maybe he'll agree or disagree. Let me stand by. Let me drop. Wesley has collected quite a number of websites. On three occasions now, he's mailed me emails saying, please look at these websites. And I have, and some of it's pretty exciting stuff on those websites, discussing machines where they appear to be finding excess energy. You put a certain amount of energy in the machine, and what you get back out appears to be greater than what you put in. So these machines, if they're real, and you can tell by the number of websites, the number of countries, the number of scientists doing the work, that quite a bit has gone into this. You can buy kits, you can buy plans, you can buy DVDs, you can buy all kinds of media where people describe how they've done it, what they've done, what they got. You can review that material, and if you like physics, it's an exciting subject. Is it real? Is an interesting question. So I am guessing that if a person wanted to follow the lead that Wesley is telling us on this one, and if you want to also look at those websites, I believe if you send the equivalent of a self-addressed envelope these days, let me drop, electronically these days with our email, if you send Wesley your return address, email address, I think he will probably also send you a copy of these websites, and you can look at these. Some of them are pretty exciting. The one that I studied the most over the last few days is the one by Peter Lindman. He's got about three of them or four of them that Wesley told me about, and I dug a little bit deeper into Peter Lindman's history over the last 30 years. A fascinating character. In the beginning, he started off with quite a bit of, occult. He had a number of occult beliefs in the beginning of his career. He seems to have refined those in the later portions of the career, where he's now concentrating on rotating magnetic machines and the excess energy. So some of those are kind of exciting, but the last three or four that you sent me, when I look at that data, I'm reasonably sure I've got an explanation. I don't think you and I are going to have the time tonight to get too deeply into that, Wesley, but interesting material. So if someone did send you their email address, would you be willing to also send them the website addresses that you sent to me so that they could also look into this? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is November to X-ray, Juliet November. My name is Wesley, and I'm just a guy who is very much controversial. At first, what I would like to start with is that I'm greatly upset with ignorance of some people, not all of them, some people. They are walking the same ways and going to the same places, and they say something is impossible. I have started many months ago as a quite completely skeptic, and the skepticism is just built in me. Then slowly I start to realize that we, maybe, I'm not saying we are, approaching the greatest revolution in the humankind existence, and that might be or might not be, I'm standing, the free energy or energy that will allow people to never again pay for the energy from the suppliers. And that may create all kinds of political or economical crisis, and what will actually have to reorganize. Now, is it true? I don't know. I do not know. One of the things that I would like to talk at least briefly, because I'm, again, limited in time, is something that I can say is one of the greatest things inside that happened. And I'm going to sound a little bit funny from the beginning of it, but if somebody listened to me carefully, he might find a great sense of it. So at first, Dick, do you like donut?
Repeater, time out.
Now, Wesley, we're going to get hollered at. Over the last 10 seconds, you timed out the machine. And so, all of us are going to have to get more disciplined on dropping the machine essentially once every minute. We all have a wristwatch, and almost all of our wristwatches have a second hand. So as we talk on this net, I think we all have to stare at our wristwatch while we're talking. And when that second hand goes around one full revolution or one and a quarter revolutions, we've got to drop the machine and wait for the beep. Otherwise, the people out of area are getting an interrupted message, and they're getting angry at us. Now, when it comes to donuts versus bagels, lately I'm not eating either one, I'm sorry to say. I like both, but because I put myself on a low-sodium diet, and by the way, I believe that people who develop retina damage in the eye, and there's many kinds of retina damage, I believe that high blood pressure, let me drop, high blood pressure that is undiagnosed is one of the major possible causative agents of eye damage, kidney damage, cardiovascular damage. The so-called silent killer of high blood pressure. Something like one-third of the population has excessive blood pressure that they do not know about. And that can create an awful lot of damage to things like the eye. And so in some cases, that's a causative agent that may be avoidable. And for some people who are salt sensitive, sodium sensitive, lowering the sodium in their diet can make significant improvement in their lifestyle, longevity, whether or not they get eye damage. Not the cure for everybody, but certainly blood pressure is something we've got to worry about. But now, so I've put myself on a low sodium diet. Most bagels, most donuts are pretty high in sodium, so I'm no longer consuming them. So I guess my answer to your question, Wesley, is none of the above. Make sure you're looking at your wristwatch, N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, N2XJN. There was a first time for, I believe, a month when I just didn't keep the time properly. I'm going to try to be more disciplined. Well, let's talk about the donut or bagel. There is a person who actually revolutionized the word, and many people do not know this name. It is good for the people to know it. Marco Rodin, M-A-R-K-O, and the last name is R-O-D-I-N. Well, he's a spiritual person, and he starts from analyzing ancient symbols from different cultures, and he created something that was not very much useful, and it looks like for ham radio operators is not useful. Well, you are that is a very wrong statement. Marco Rodin has discovered the source of the non-decaying spin of electron. Also, scientists know that all electrons in the universe spin. They have never discovered the source of that spin. Let me drop for a moment.
Well done.
Okay. Rodin has discovered that under spinning geometry of the universe, he discovered the underspinning geometry of the universe, the fabric of itself. He has done that by reducing all of the higher mathematics calculus, geometry, scalar math, to discrete number of mathematics. Guess what he got? He introduced the word vortex-based mathematics, where you will be able to see how geometry is expressing in its mathematical form. The math does not have anomalies and shows the dimensional shape and functions of the universe as being a thyroid or donut shape black hole. As a matter of fact, he states that he is able to create a black hole on his table. Let me drop for a moment. That's what I was actually very much against what Dick was talking when I was talking to the Dick, that the person that I'm referring to are not recognized. Well, now I have a recognized one. The Professor Scott Nelson of the University of Hawaii actually confirmed his theory. The Bush time, he was at airspace of America Convention, and he was teaching his physics matters. The Rose Blank, formerly tenure of researcher of Microsoft, find out that by applying his mathematics, he is able to speed up twice his application by reducing the numbers. That means by minimizing the size of the programs. Let me drop.
Wesley, I'm going to have to interrupt you for now because we've got this deadline of around 11 o'clock to go over to the mailbag, and I've got to go over to Glenn. So I'm going to interrupt you for now, but after we cover Glenn and the mailbag, we can come back to the subject. Is that all right with you? Over to you, Wesley, KQRIW.
Yes, of course. One thing that I would like to just say to keep people interested with the subject is that he was able to build a coil that is quite unique, very quite unique. And as a matter of fact, Dick, I have a new antenna that I would like to discuss with you, and eventually ask you to work with me on it. And maybe that is a chance to apply for the patent application. Back to you.
Sounds kind of exciting. And what you and I normally do is we run into each other two or three times during the week quite often. Most likely that'll happen this week in between the TechNets, and we'll discuss some of these subjects. And then we'll give people on the TechNet next Sunday night the condensation of what we discuss. Glenn quite often is involved in these discussions. We almost discover the state of the universe, but we haven't quite pinned it all down, but Glenn's got a little more of the story, and I'm going to pass it over to Glenn now. KC2QIQ. I'm having some fun with you, Glenn. KQRIW TechNet. Make sure you look at your watch.
WV2E for 1 second first.
Okay, go right ahead, Ed.
We're referring to an article found through West rotating magnetic devices. I would see that. I have my email.
Okay. If you write to Wesley and to XJN, most likely he's got that list for you. Just to make sure you get it, I'll also send you what I know, the websites I've got. So I'll be sending that to you, Ed. Glenn, KC2QIQ, look at your watch and have at it. You got it, Glenn.
Oh, very good, Dick. Good evening. I just wanted to get back to you a little bit about during the weekend, I think the last TechNet, we were talking about coaxial cable and ladder line radiation. And on that note, I took a couple of lengths of LMR-400 coax and some 450-ohm ladder line. The lengths were 10 feet, 30 feet, and 100 feet. And I just figured I'd take a signal generator and load the output with a few different impedances, say 25 ohms, 50 ohms, 100 ohms, 1K, and then basically put a 100 pop capacitor on the end and kind of look at what the results would be. So I did this, and I was at the same time measuring with a Rodin-Schwarz analyzer to see what kind of pickup with a near-field probe, see what kind of signals I could get coming up off the coax. Let me let it reset.
Tonight at 8 o'clock.
And what my results have shown.
No, I don't think you timed out, but all of a sudden you're not coming through the machine. You do have a PL turned on. The last 10 seconds you did time. You didn't come through the machine.
KC2FFA.
KC2FFA recognized, but stand by, Glenn. I think you've lost your PL because I'm hearing you on the input, but you're not coming through the machine.
Okay, Dick, is that better right there?
Roger, Dodger. Was it the PL tone disappearing?
Apparently. Sorry about that. about that. Okay, basically what I'd measured just going back through this was looking for sniffing across the length of the coax to see if I could pick up any kind of radiation off of the center of the coax. And I guess what really surprised me, maybe you can add some more to this, is that it really didn't matter too much whether I was using the 10-foot length, the 30-foot length, or the 100-foot length. Whether I put 50 ohms on either end of the coax or mismatches, I was not able to detect very much of anything with a near-field probe coming off of the coax whatsoever. You know, sweeping between 3 megahertz to about 500 megahertz, you know, single frequencies, and doing a wideband sweep with a Rodin-Schwarz analyzer and a near-field. And, I mean, you could see a little bit of pickup, but, you know, way, way, way down, very, very small signals. And with the ladder line, if I got close to within, you know, 2 inches of it, I could start to measure something. But I was even surprised with large mismatches on the other end of the either the ladder line or the coax. There didn't seem to be a whole heck of a lot leaking off of there, which kind of leaves me with a... I could start measuring a lot when I got to either end where the solder connections were, especially in the mismatches. But along the overall length, I didn't see much in the near fields, which leads me to believe that coax and ladder line, either one, don't radiate as much as I originally thought they did. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Fantastic. If I understand what you're telling me, with your 10-foot, 30-foot, 100-foot lengths of both LMR 400 and 450-ohm ladder line, where you put various kinds of load at the far end, both resistive and reactive loads, making standing wave ratio, and you and I know that I can tune across the 20-meter ham band any day of the week, and lots of knowledgeable hams will tell you that if your antenna is being fed with open wire line, ladder line, and if the antenna has a high standing wave ratio, that you are drastically increasing the amount of radiation of the feed line. It's sending out signals. Lots and lots of guys will be saying that. Until you got extremely close to those individual wires of the ladder line, I think you're telling me you saw very little radiation. That even in a high standing wave ratio or a reasonably high standing wave ratio environment, the cable stayed acting as a shielded structure. I think that's what you just told me. And if so, it's awfully good news. KC2QIQ, wait for the beep. K2RIW.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying, Vic, and that's the result. And what's really interesting is where the noise, in other words, where I could see it, and it was especially during the mismatches, especially with putting like a 100 puff capacitor on the other end, is boy, when I got close to that 100 puff capacitor, wow, it was hot right there. You could measure a signal. Or on the other end, when it got close to the generator, which is, you know, close to a 50 ohm output. You know, granted, these are relatively low signal levels, but then again, I've got a lot of dynamic range on that Rodin-Schwarz analyzer, and it's a very, very slow sweep. So, you know, when you just lay the near-field probe along the lengths, and I mean, I took a little bit of time doing this, too, with different lengths and different loads, and I was expecting to see much more coming off off of coax. And really, interestingly enough, it was at the ends where, if anything, I saw something, but not anywhere along the length of the coax with a near-field probe, which leads me to believe that, okay, maybe if the connections are bad and right at the mismatch, but I think the whole idea that the transmission line actually is radiating anything weird, I mean, in even close to an order of magnitude as the antenna, it's kind of like proven, at least to me, that that's highly unlikely.
Fantastic. Glenn, I don't think you should keep this particular bright light under your bushel basket. That's a slang of saying that I recommend that you report this to the technical topics of QST Magazine. Throw in some pictures and diagrams, but tell them what you saw and how this drastically cuts into an extremely popular myth, the urban myth that every ham radio operator on 20 meters has been telling each other year after year after year. The story is so widespread, everyone believes it. They're sure it's the gospel. No one has gone and checked it. And along comes a guy, let me drop, with a little bit more scientific bent and a crazy crazy little place called Massapequa, Long Island. And he goes and makes the measurement. He doesn't just take the old wives' tale stories and swallow it whole. He went out and made the measurement.